Walk Me Through the Orchard, a podcast dedicated to honoring the stories of the people of Grand New Hill. I'm Kristen Ridge, creator and host. Today we have someone really special with us, Larry Johnson. Born in 1942 at his parents' first home in Bingham Canyon, Larry moved to Grandview Hill when he was 1 month old and has lived all of his 81 years here. Grandview Hill sits on the far northwest corner of Provo, close to Geneva Road and the I-15 freeway. Established in 1912, it eventually became home to about 30 families from the 1930s onward, until it became subdivided towards the end of the 20th century. The families had large properties that held orchards of apples, pears, apricots, peaches, and cherries, and there were enormous strawberry and raspberry patches. Larry's family had a homestead here where they grew cherries, pears, apricots, and alfalfa. Larry was trained in construction and eventually built a number of the homes on Grandview when it was subdivided, including mine. Today he will share with us a few treasured memories about what life was like as a farming family in the 1940s and 50s, as well as some of the long-ago landmarks in this small community: the blacksmith shop, the mercantile, and the local watering hole for farmers. We'll also hear a couple interesting stories about the contention his family had between others for water usage. One of them involves the family strawberry patch, an incident that took place when Larry was about 15. Larry, thank you so much for being here today for our very first episode of Walk Me Through the Orchard. A couple years ago, you shared with me your autobiography, which was so rich and delightful to read. And I was so excited when you agreed to participate in this storytelling podcast. Today, you're going to share with us some stories of the local joints and what life was like here on Grandview Hill in the 1940s and 50s. Why don't you take it away?
Yes, there's been a lot of changes, some good and some bad. Depends on who you are and how you look at it. The population has changed dramatically. Chris and I counted the homes on a aerial photo, and there were only about 30 homes in the total Grandview area. And now one block will give you that many. So it's changes have been made. My uncles and my father owned about probably a third of Grandview Hill. And they were either gifted it or they bought it and raised fruit trees. And all of that is gone. That's a change. When I was younger, I had a summer job all the time between all the uncles and everything they had to do. And so never lacked for work. And that's...
Now, you had some really interesting details about what things cost back then. Like, for example, what was the price of gasoline?
Gasoline was 18 cents a gallon.
Wow.
The district gasoline provider would come up to the farm, fill a 55-gallon barrel for $9.
Wow.
And that was something that I thought that was a lot of money at the time. But things have changed. And so...
Yeah, and I remember that you said that there was not many farmers that used tractors. They would use horses. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't remember a lot. You know, I was born in 42, and that probably my memory goes back to 1948 when I was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember my father being out in the field and running a couple of horses. They did everything with horses. They marked out the orchards so that it could be irrigated. They hauled hay with the wagons and used them to pull the hay up into the barn. And so he had some special names for those horses, especially when he got frustrated. And I grew up thinking that was their name. And Mom told me one day, she says, "No, that's not their name." And so we went on to something better from there. But
that's great.
During that period of time, if they did buy a piece of machinery, they used to share the cost on it two or three farmers would go together and pay for it, and then they'd arrange to use it at a certain time, and that kind of got them through the hard times.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finally were able to buy a sprayer, they shared that also. Well, you spray the fruit trees with, and so that was a benefit.
Hmm. Yeah, those things are so interesting, and I especially want to hear about some of the local places around here. There was a blacksmith shop, a mercantile, and a cafe that you remember. Do you want to tell us about any of those places?
Sure. Where the Spring Creek goes through Lyons Park and intersects Columbia Lane, goes under Columbia Lane, there was a fish pond on the east side of the Columbia Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And it run under the road and then down into Lyons Park. Good fishing hole. I think that's where I caught my first fish.
Mm.
And frog ponds, we'd go down there and catch frogs. That's something that's non-existent now. I haven't seen a frog. I go out in nature quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen a frog for, I'll bet you, 10 years.
Oh, they might be completely gone.
Yeah, there was a period of time when we'd go down on Harbor Road on the north side of the river, and we went through there one time, and there was a migration of frogs going across that street, and there were just dead frogs all over because cars go down the street and, mm-hmm. and hit them and kill them.
Mm.
But they're not there now. It's just not there. But anyway, down Lyons Park, where 1460 comes off the hill now, that was something that changed too, because the hill would drop off right at the corner of the Grandview property,
mm-hmm.
Grandview School, and you could stand there and look down on the Spring Creek. And down in the meadow down there, about July or so, there was a big camp of gypsies that would move in there.
That's interesting.
And my aunt, I guess she lived just down Jordan Avenue, clear to the end, and she, as long as she could remember, they were coming there.
Mm-hmm.
And so she warned us, she says, if you don't want to come home, or if you want to run away, go down there and play with the gypsies. She says, because they'll snag on to you. And yeah, we wouldn't go near them. So,
that was all she had to say.
Yeah. But it was fun to watch them. They'd build big fires and sing songs and dance and play instruments and kind of like a circus. But, and on that same plane, back down where the Spring Creek goes under Columbia Lane, if you go west,
mm-hmm.
across the road by the, it's a nerve center there now, there was a blacksmith shop.
Oh.
And he built a little frame house there. He was a war veteran, and he got wounded pretty bad, so he had a bad limp. And he lived in that little frame house. I can see it right now.
Mm.
And he had a weir box out in front. A weir box is where you guide the water in so you can access it.
Mm,
pump
right.
it out and or whatever, and he had an in pipe and an out pipe and a tin cup there,
mm.
and it was fed by a spring, and it was a pretty good flow.
Really?
It would flow probably 5 gallons a minute coming through there.
So he didn't use the dug canals. He used that spring.
Well, yeah, it was just drinking water.
That
was the first thing I do when I go down there, go grab that tin cup and get a good swig of spring water.
So you spent some time down there with him.
Oh, yeah. My dad and him are friends, and my grandmother, Bernardi, thought he walked on water because he fixed her fridge. She couldn't get the fridge to run, and he came up. He was a go-to guy on fixing stuff. And, call Charlie. And... he did come up and fix it. Of course, he liked her and she liked him. But that blossomed into nothing. And they were both single. But
yeah,
he would fix, sharpen plow shears. If you had something that broke, he'd weld it. And he was just an all-around fix-it guy when it came to metal. And so...
And what was his name?
Charlie Guthridge.
Charlie Guthridge. So it sounds like he really, people relied on him for so many things.
Yeah.
Not just the ironworks.
Yeah, yeah. He was
amazing.
And if you wanted advice, he'd give you that too.
Oh. That's what he's, that's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. If, and then if you go back to Columbia Lane and go down towards the river, about two-thirds of the way to the river, there was a little mercantile store on the south side of the Columbia Lane. And it wasn't, it might have been 25 feet wide and about 50 feet deep. And it had a storefront, one of those Western square.
Oh, straight.
And he had,
like
it had a stress sign painted up there. Dean's Market was what it was called. And a lot of the people didn't buy the bulk of their goods there, but they'd go down there, you know, when they had to snag something quick and in an emergency. And all the kids went down there and bought soda pop. And, of course, you know, you could buy a Coke for a nickel. And that was something that was really good.
How long did he have his mercantile set up? About what year did he finally go out?
I want to say probably in 55.
Okay.
It lasted about 10 or 12 years. But he was there for a long time.
Right, since
early.
Before you were born. And
Yeah. Early on he was there. And if you head on down towards the river a little farther, there was a cafe on the north side of the street where Deseret Industries is now. And it was, I can't remember if it was Pay or Pace. I think it was Pace.
Pace sounds right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it was the watering hole for all the farmers. And anybody who wants some advice, they go in there and trade yarns, I guess you could say. And the farmers would go there and talk about how what they were doing to get a better crop or what they were going to spray with this year and where they were going to get it and all that good stuff, you know. One time, there was a man named Ray Burningham. He had a barn up here about a third of the way down to the west on 1460 North.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Dryland Farm in Indian Hills. Of course, Indian Hills is all developed fancy houses and stuff now.
It is.
And but that Dryland Farm, they would bunch the grain, whether it was barley, wheat, or whatever it was. They'd bunch it into bunches, and the machine would just throw it out on the row there.
Hmm.
And we'd go up and help him stack it in bunches so that big, you know, more volume to it. And when they bring the thresher in there, they just pull that thresher down and then thresh a pile of it and then go on to another pile. Hmm. And when we got through, we'd go for hunt the rabbits around there, shoot them with a .22.
Mm.
And then we went back, stopped at Pace's, and got a Coke.
Yeah.
And I thought I was sitting up at the bar stool, and I was big time.
You were the big stuff.
And, of course, all the guys that knew me come along and say, "What are you drinking?" And I said, "Coke."
Yeah.
Yeah. I know they had beer and coffee and everything else, but, yeah. Want to know something else?
These are fascinating stories, and I want to transition to talking about something else that was shared between families, because earlier you mentioned that farmers would share their equipment, but they also had to share water. And you have a few interesting stories about the contention that sometimes happened with water sharing. One of them was when you were about 15 and you were with your Uncle Frank, and I think people would love to hear that story. if you want to tell it.
Yeah. We'd planned on planting a strawberry patch, which is would be down in the Delabout property now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about probably an acre or acre and a half. And we worked all morning getting the strawberries in the ground. And then my uncle went up. In the springtime, they didn't have the schedule cards printed out early in the spring. And so if you needed water, you just go get it. And or else call the water master if there wasn't any coming down the ditches. So Frank went up, turned the water down. It was going down 1460. And he just put the gate in. And he says, "Oh, it won't take too long to water it," he says. And so he come back, and about 30 minutes later, this guy named C.S. Dawson, he had a big ranch or farm down on the end where 1460 goes north.
Mm-hmm.
And he come down, he says, "Who the hell put that gate in up there?" And Frank says, "I did."
Oh.
And he says, "Well, I'm going to go put it the other way." He says, "I got some pear trees that haven't been, they've been planted for 2 weeks and they only got their water on them once." And Frank says, "Well, if you could wait a while towards evening," he says, "and then take it." He says, "These strawberries aren't going to last that long." And he says, "Well, hell no," he says, "I'm going to get it now."
Hmm.
And so Frank, or C.S., had come down from my mom's home or where I lived, and Frank stepped around that side of him,
mm-hmm.
and he says, "I am not going to let you get that water." And C.S. says, "Well, how the hell are you going to stop me?" And Frank picked up his shovel and he says, "You want me to show you?"
Hmm.
And C.S. says, "Don't get hot now," he says. And Frank says, "Well, I've got the water and I'm going to keep it."
Mm.
And C.S., he started walking back up towards Mother's house, and Frank jumped in front of him. He says, "You get your ass out of here." And he says, "And you can walk home and think about that."
Mm-hmm.
And but Frank was fired up. I've never seen him. When he gets mad, he gets really mad. And so C.S., he just hightailed it through the fields and back home.
And he had to walk all the way down the hill because Frank had blocked his truck with a shovel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, that's what you get when you try to...
There's another story about getting the water. We had a stake president. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the stake president then, but he later on, he was a stake president for probably 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Clyde Lunsford. And somehow it was the same thing. Dad needed water, and he went up and, oh no, it was our turn with the water.
It was your turn.
Yeah, and Dad had gone up in the early morning and turned the water down, and before long, he took the head gate and threw it out in the weeds.
Mm.
So I couldn't turn it back down.
Yeah, the head gate's the wheel, right?
No, it's just a board that you put in a concrete structure and it directs the water.
Got it.
So a head gate. And Clyde, he comes storming down. Somehow he got a hold of Dad on the phone, and next thing we know, he was showing up, and he walked right in the shop.
Hmm.
And Dad always kept a .22 automatic above the door, and I guess for protection or whatever. And old Clyde walked into the shop, and there's a big beam that supported the garage doors, and Dad fired about 3 shots into that.
Hmm.
And old Clyde comes storming out of there like a bear was chasing him. And he said, "What the hell? You could have hit me with that." And Dad says, "If I wanted to, I would have." He says, you get your butt out of my garage and I don't want to see you in there ever again.
Hmm.
But
interesting.
And my dad could get madder than mad could be, and the next day he'd shake hands with whoever he was mad at. And I guess he figured, well, bygones be bygones.
Well, yeah, you'd have to have that sort of temperament of letting things go in order to just be able to thrive in this community where you're sharing so many things.
Yeah.
You know, since I didn't grow up in this period, I think it's just fascinating to think about sharing water with other families. Because now, obviously, families don't share any resources with anybody. And water is undoubtedly the most important resource we have. And so I think, how would I behave towards someone that was taking water from me or wouldn't wait for my turn to be over? And there's no one to call. The schedule hadn't been printed yet. So I kind of think that a shovel and a shotgun would be reasonable solutions.
Yeah.
I am curious, were people like widows vulnerable to being intimidated by people wanting to take their water? Or how did that, you know, families that maybe weren't traditional or didn't have a husband in the home, did that affect how their water usage during this pre-springtime?
Well, I didn't know many widows that lived up here because life was hard. And if something happened to the husband, they got married again pretty quick or moved on.
So women weren't, I guess my question stems from wondering if women were ever involved in the scuffle for water or if it was just the men.
I think it was mostly just the men.
Mm-hmm.
There was one woman that I stood in awe of, and that was Jane Birmingham. She was a Dutch lady, and she was over 6 feet tall.
Wow.
And one day I was riding my bicycle down past their place, going to my Bernardi grandparents' house. And she was out there with a 10-pound sludge breaking one of the little head gate things out because they had to put a new one in.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she broke it out.
Wow.
Threw it up in the wagon.
Wow.
And I thought, well.
Well, she was tough.
Yeah, she was. She was. Huh. She ran a cleaning shop down in on Center Street.
A cleaning shop?
Yeah, laundry.
Oh, laundry shop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, Larry, I think about these stories you've shared with us today, and I can really see how meaningful the simplicity of the farm life and culture is to you. And I just thought I'd ask you, what are you most proud of in terms of how your life and how your upbringing shaped you, the person you are?
Well, you know, early on, people used to tell the guys that did heavy labor, you're going to be sorry you did that. You know, we used to work 12, 14 hours a day lifting bushels of pears, mm-hmm. put 75 or so on a trailer and out of the orchard. And I look back and I don't have any regrets because I don't have any problems. And I think the bottom line is if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you stronger. So
I heard my grandfather say that several times.
Uh-huh. And and living in Grandview back then, nowadays everybody gets bored. The kids get bored. Mm-hmm. And I probably had it better. You know, they think they got it good now. They don't have to go out and work or do things. But I had a horse. I could jump on that horse whenever I wanted to and ride off into the sunset and not come home until dark.
Right. You had a lot of freedom.
And yeah, I did. And there was a few guys around that was short a few bricks. they'd sometimes go past the house, and Mother would say, now, don't say anything, just let him go by. Mm-hmm. And he'd go by, and we'd go back out. But, life was so much simpler, and you always had something you could do. You know, go out in the orchard and keep the birds out of the cherries, or and if you got bored, Dad would find something for you to do that you didn't really want to do.
Absolutely.
And so you stayed clear. No whining about being bored.
Larry, thank you so much for sharing these special memories with us.
That's it for this episode of Walk Me Through the Orchard. Join me next week for episode 2 as we listen to Val and Julian Kendall. Don't forget, we'd love to hear your story too. Please contact me at 801-687-1044 if you'd like to share a story.